Chapter 40. Suggested agonizing fear, rage of murder, ferocity of lust, and the irremediable joylessness of human condition. Yet they were emitted by people who were convinced that they were amusing themselves supremely, traditionally, with the sanction of ages, with the approval of their conscience, and no mistake about it whatever. Our appearance, the soberness of our gait made us conspicuous. Once or twice, by common inspiration, masks rushed forward, and forming a circle danced round us uttering discordant shouts of derision. For we were an outrage to the peculiar proprieties of the hour, and besides we were obviously lonely and defenseless. On those occasions there was nothing for it, but to stand still till the flurry was over. My companion, however, would stamp his feet with rage, and I must admit that I myself regretted not having provided for our wearing a couple of false noses, which would have been enough to placate the just resentment of those people. We might have also joined in the dance, but for some reason or other it didn't occur to us, and I heard once a high, clear woman's voice stigmatizing us for a species of swelled heads, espistenfels. We proceeded sedately, my companion muttered with rage, and I was able to resume my thinking. It was based on the deep persuasion that the man at my side was insane with quite another than carnivalesque lunacy which comes on at one stated time of the year. He was fundamentally mad, though not perhaps completely. Which of course made him all the greater, I won't say danger, but nuisance. I remember once a young doctor expounding the theory that most catastrophes in family circles, surprising episodes in public affairs and disasters in private life, had their origin in the fact that the world was full of half-mad people. He asserted that they were the real majority. When asked whether he considered himself as belonging to the majority, he said frankly that he didn't think so, unless the folly of voicing this view in a company so utterly unable to appreciate all its horror could be regarded as the first symptom of his own fate. We shouted down him and his theory, but there is no doubt that it had thrown a chill on the gaiety of our gathering. We had now entered a quieter quarter of the town and Senor Ortega had ceased his muttering. For myself, I had not the slightest doubt of my own sanity. It was proved to me by the way I could apply my intelligence to the problem of what was to be done with Senor Ortega. Generally, he was unfit to be trusted with any mission whatever. The instability of his temper was sure to get him into a scrape. Of course, carrying a letter to headquarters was not a very complicated matter. And as to that, I would have trusted willingly a properly trained dog. My private letter to Dona Rita, the wonderful, the unique letter of farewell, I had given up for the present. Naturally, I thought of the Ortega problem mainly in the terms of Dona Rita's safety. Her image presided at every council, at every conflict of my mind, and dominated every faculty of my senses. It floated before my eyes, it touched my elbow, it guarded my right side and my left side. My ear seemed to catch the sound of her footsteps behind me. She enveloped me with passing whiffs of warmth and perfume, with filmy touches of the hair on my face. She penetrated me, my head was full of her. And his head too, I thought suddenly with a side glance at my companion. He walked quietly with hunched up shoulders carrying his little handbag, and he looked the most commonplace figure imaginable. Yes, there was between us a most horrible fellowship. The association of his crazy torture with the sublime suffering of my passion. We hadn't been a quarter of an hour together when that woman had surged up fatally between us, between this miserable wretch and myself. We were haunted by the same image. But I was sane. I was sane. Not because I was certain that the fellow must not be allowed to go to Tolosa, but because I was perfectly alive to the difficulty of stopping him from going there, since the decision was absolutely in the hands of Baron H. If I were to go early in the morning and tell that fat, bilious man, "Look here, your Ortega's mad," he would certainly think at once that I was, get very frightened, and... One couldn't tell what course he would take. He would eliminate me somehow out of the affair. and yet I could not let the fellow proceed to where Dona Rita was, because, obviously, he had been molesting her, had filled her with uneasiness and even alarm, was an unhappy element and a disturbing influence in her life, incredible as the thing appeared. I couldn't let him go on to make himself a worry and a nuisance, drive her out from a town in which he wished to be for whatever reason, and perhaps start some explosive scandal. And that girl Rose seemed to fear something graver even than a scandal. But if I were to explain the matter fully, to H he would simply rejoice in his heart. Nothing would please him more than to have Dona Rita driven out of Tolosa. What a relief from his anxieties and his wife's too. And if I were to go further, if I even went so far as to hint at the fears which Rose had not been able to conceal from me, why then I went on thinking coldly with a stoical rejection of the most elementary faith in mankind's rectitude. Why then, that accommodating husband would simply let the ominous messenger have his chance. He would see there only his natural anxieties being laid to rest forever. Horrible? Yes. But I could not take the risk. In a 12-month I had traveled a long way in my mistrust of mankind. We paced on steadily. I thought, how on earth am I going to stop you? Had this arisen only a month before, when I had the means at hand and Dominic to confide in, I would have simply kidnapped the fellow. A little trip to sea would not have done Senor Ortega any harm, though no doubt it would have been abhorrent to his feelings. But now I had not the means. I couldn't even tell where my poor Dominic was hiding his diminished head. Again I glanced at him sideways. I was the taller of the two, and as it happened I met in the light of the street lamp his own stealthy glance directed up at me with an agonized expression, an expression that made me fancy I could see the man's very soul writhing in his body like an impaled worm. In spite of my utter inexperience I had some notion of the images that rushed into his mind at the sight of any man who had approached Dona Rita. It was enough to awaken in any human being a movement of horrified compassion. But my pity went out not to him, but to Dona Rita. It was for her that I felt sorry. I pitied her for having that damned soul on her track. I pitied her with tenderness and indignation, as if this had been both a danger and a dishonor. I don't mean to say that those thoughts passed through my head consciously. I had only the resultant, settled feeling. I had, however, a thought too. It came on me suddenly, and I asked myself with rage and astonishment, must I then kill that brute? There didn't seem to be any alternative. Between him and Dona Rita I couldn't hesitate. I believe I gave a slight laugh of desperation. The suddenness of this sinister conclusion had in it something comic and unbelievable. It loosened my grip on my mental processes. A Latin tag came into my head about the facile descent into the abyss. I marveled at its aptness, and also that it should have come to me so pat. But I believe now that it was suggested simply by the actual declivity of the street of the consuls, which lies on a gentle slope. We had just turned the corner. All the houses were dark, and in a perspective of complete solitude our two shadows dodged and wheeled about our feet. Here we are, I said. He was an extraordinarily chilly devil. When we stopped I could hear his teeth chattering again. I don't know what came over me, I had a sort of nervous fit, was incapable of finding my pockets, let alone the latchkey. I had the illusion of a narrow streak of light on the wall of the house, as if it had been cracked. Hope we will be able to get in, I murmured. Senor Ortega stood waiting patiently with his handbag, like a rescued wayfarer. You live in this house, don't you? He observed. No, I said, without hesitation. I didn't know how that man would behave if he were aware that I was staying under the same roof. He was half mad. He might want to talk all night, try crazily to invade my privacy. How could I tell? Moreover, I wasn't so sure that I would remain in the house. I had some notion of going out again, and walking up and down the street of the consuls till daylight. Oh, an absent friend lets me use. I had that latchkey this morning. Here it is, I let him go in first. The sickly gas flame was there on duty, undaunted, waiting for the end of the world to come and put it out. I think that the black and white hall surprised Ortega. I had closed the front door without noise, and stood for a moment listening, while he glanced about furtively. There were only two other doors in the hall, right and left. Their panels of ebony were decorated with bronze applications in the center. The one on the left was of course Blunt's door. As the passage leading beyond it was dark at the further end, I took Senor Ortega by the hand, and led him along, unresisting, like a child. For some reason or other I moved on tiptoe, and he followed my example. The light and the warmth of the studio impressed him favorably. He laid down his little bag, rubbed his hands together, and produced a smile of satisfaction. But it was such a smile as a totally ruined man would perhaps force on his lips, or a man condemned to a short shrift by his doctor. I begged him to make himself at home and said that I would go at once and hunt up the woman of the house who would make him up a bed on the big couch there. He hardly listened to what I said. What were all those things to him? He knew that his destiny was to sleep on a bed of thorns, to feed on adders. But he tried to show a sort of polite interest. He asked, "How does this place?" "It used to belong to a painter," I mumbled. "Ah, your absent friend," he said, making a wry mouth. "Detest all those artists, and all those writers, and all politicos who are thieves. And I would go even farther and higher, laying a curse on all idle lovers of women. You think perhaps I am a royalist?" "No. If there was anybody in heaven or hell to pray to, I would pray for a revolution, a red revolution everywhere." "You astonish me," I said, "just to say something." "No. But there are half a dozen people in the world with whom I would like to settle accounts. One could shoot them like partridges, and no questions asked. That's what revolution would mean to me." "It's a beautifully simple view," I said. "Imagine you are not the only one who holds it, but I really must look after your comforts. You mustn't forget that we have to see Baron H early tomorrow morning." And I went out quietly into the passage, wondering in what part of the house Teresa had elected to sleep that night. But, lo and behold, when I got to the foot of the stairs, there was Therese coming down from the upper regions in her nightgown, like a sleepwalker. However, it wasn't that, because, before I could exclaim, she vanished off the first floor landing like a streak of white mist, and without the slightest sound. Her attire made it perfectly clear that she could not have heard us coming in. In fact, she must have been certain that the house was empty, because she was as well aware as myself that the Italian girls after their work at the opera were going to a masked ball to dance for their own amusement, attended of course by their conscientious father. But what thought, need, or sudden impulse had driven Therese out of bed like this was something I couldn't conceive. I didn't call out after her. I felt sure that she would return. I went up slowly to the first floor, and met her coming down again, this time carrying a lighted candle. As she had managed to make herself presentable in an extraordinarily short time. "Oh, my dear young monsieur, you have given me a fright." "Yes. And I nearly fainted too," I said. "You looked perfectly awful. What's the matter with you? Are you ill?" As he had lighted by then the gas on the landing, and I must say that I had never seen exactly that manner of face on her before. She wriggled, confused and shifty-eyed, before me, but I ascribed this behavior to her shocked modesty, and without troubling myself any more about her feelings, I informed her that there was a Carlist downstairs who must be put up for the night. Most unexpectedly, she betrayed a ridiculous consternation. But only for a moment. Then she assumed at once that I would give him hospitality upstairs, where there was a camp bedstead in my dressing room. I said, "No. Give him a shakedown in the studio, where he is now. It's warm in there. And remember, I charge you strictly not to let him know that I sleep in this house. In fact, I don't know myself that I will. I have certain matters to attend to this very night. You will also have to serve him his coffee in the morning. I will take him away before 10 o'clock. All this seemed to impress her more than I had expected. As usual, when she felt curious, or in some other way excited, she assumed a saintly, detached expression, and asked, "The dear gentleman is your friend, I suppose?" "I only know he is a Spaniard and a Carlist," I said. "Indeed, that ought to be enough for you." Instead of the usual effusive exclamations, she murmured, dear me," and departed upstairs with the candle, to get together a few blankets and pillows, I suppose. As for me, I walked quietly downstairs on my way to the studio. I had a curious sensation that I was acting in a preordained manner, that life was not at all what I had thought it to be, or else that I had been altogether changed sometime during the day, and that I was a different person from the man whom I remembered getting out of my bed in the morning. Also, feelings had altered all their values. The words, too, had become strange. It was only the inanimate surroundings that remained what they had always been. For instance, the studio. During my absence, Senor Ortega had taken off his coat, and I found him, as it were, in the air, sitting in his shirt sleeves on a chair which he had taken pains to place in the very middle of the floor. I repressed an absurd impulse to walk round him, as though he had been some sort of exhibit. His hands were spread over his knees, and he looked perfectly insensible. I don't mean strange, or ghastly, or wooden, but just insensible like an exhibit. And that effect persisted, even after he raised his black suspicious eyes to my face. He lowered them almost at once. It was very mechanical. I gave him up, and became rather concerned about myself. My thought was that I had better get out of that before any more queer notions came into my head. So I only remained long enough to tell him that the woman of the house was bringing down some bedding, and that I hoped that he would have a good night's rest. And directly I spoke, it struck me that this was the most extraordinary speech that ever was addressed to a figure of that sort. He, however, did not seem startled by it, or moved in any way. He simply said, "Thank you." In the darkest part of the long passage outside, I met Therese with her arms full of pillows and blankets. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.